This is a production of Cornell University.
This is the third meeting of the Cornell Graduate and Professional Student Assembly, February 20th, 2012, 5:30 p.m., Millott Hall, Bach Auditorium. Welcome, everybody. We'll do a quick roll call of the voting members and then move to our first item on the agenda. Randa Adra. Kyle Albert.
Here.
Brian Alkemeyer.
Here.
Steve Ahn.
Here.
Nicole Brand is excused. YJ Chen.
Here.
John Chechelewski.
Here.
Evan Cortens here. Andrew Elliott.
Here.
Carl Furkenhoff.
Here.
Marquise Hawkins.
Here.
Yevgeny Israelit. Absent James Keach.
Here.
Allison Nash.
Here.
Rebecca Robbins.
Here.
Eric Smith.
Here.
Mia Tutil.
Here.
Michelle White.
Here.
Crystal Wilson. Excellent. Welcome, everybody. Our first item on the agenda is Almira Mangum, Vice President for Planning and Budget. Almira.
Range. Debt is about 3.8% of our overall operating expenditure.
So that gives you kind of an overview of what the operating budget looks like. You see a lot of activity on campus, and we refer to the buildings and that activity as a capital plan. This is a five-year capital plan. The five-year capital plan at the beginning of this fiscal year was $1.6 billion, almost $1.7 billion. And most of those projects and expenditures that will occur over that five-year period are for the categories that you see listed here. Many of the expenditures, a little under $400 million, will be spent and is being spent in the current fiscal year. So our capital planning process, while it's a five-year plan, we also budget annually, and we approve an annual operating or annual capital budget expenditure plan. And within this $1.67 billion plan, we have projects that have been approved that are underway of about $100 million, the $9.77. Those projects were things that didn't come on the table just last year, but they've been there during the full course of this five-year plan up to this day. We also have capital funding for projects that are funded by New York State, as you see noted there. Also, Wild Medical College capital is included in this activity. Basically, the point here is that the five-year plan represents a reduction in activity from the previous year. In fact, the campus has expenditure guidelines now that require every capital project to be fully funded before a shovel goes in the ground. And that's the big change that's occurred since 2008-2009 in our capital activity. You'll notice also that the decline to 11% was preceded in the previous year by a 24% reduction in capital activity. And it's still 37% smaller than it was in 2009 when it crashed occurred. One of the major sets of activities that we're involved in now, so that just gives you a framework of the size of the budget and the kind of activity that's taking place on campus, capital-wise, as well as the regular operating activities. The cost savings measure to help us get control over our budget that was started basically 2 years ago and had been planned for as part of Reimagining Cornell to reduce our administrative costs and to start trying to control some of the administrative costs at the center as well as to some degree in the distributed unit. I'm sorry, you probably can't see this really well, but there are several initiatives and it's also included on our website. But the administrative streamlining program was focused on several initiatives. It was on procurement, where plans were devised to reduce our overall spend by using strategic sourcing as a methodology to negotiate better pricing for our goods and services that we purchased across the institution. There is also a spans and layers, which was basically an organizational restructuring that was designed to change the organizational structure, size it so that each employee would not be more than six steps away from their supervisor in terms of management. So the idea there was to reduce some of the layers and increase the spans across the institution. The specific amounts that each of those initiatives was designed to address are listed here. But basically, we were looking to pull about $75 to $80 million out of the administrative operating budget over the next several years. So information technology is one of those initiatives that we were looking to try and save resources by changing the way that we deliver services as well as some of the technology used and software used in service delivery. The provost office, which you may hear a lot about the GP budget and what it funds, one of the things that we were focused on there is to try to reduce the amount of resources that we from the center provide for initiatives and for startup activity to colleges, schools, as well as administrative areas. Senator Nicholas is not another one of those controlling factors that we wanted to make sure that we moved to a place where many of the centers and institutes that we start become self-sustaining by the nature of the research and the activity that they bring in, so it's not to be a permanent call on the GP resources of the institution. So it's kind of like a startup or venture capital fund, you put it, you know, in terms of what centers and institutes were doing to try to encourage collaborative work across the different colleges and different fields. The finance initiative and student and academic service initiative were more related to activities that occur within the Division of Financial Affairs and the administrative offices of Student and Academic Services across the sports and other things where they could try and look at their operations, enterprise included, to try and drive down some of their operating costs. Human resources was also another area where we were looking to provide service groups, service centers, to streamline the operations to improve, make it more efficient as well as more effective. Not all of the initiatives involved in these items and communications as well were designed to reduce costs. Some of them involved just becoming more efficient in service delivery. So we have an efficiency motive as well as a service motive to provide better quality and improvement of services, which included upgrading some of the software and administrative systems that were involved in service delivery. Now, to more about the outlook and where we're headed, our focus remains on quality and access. So in pursuit of that goal, which I think was stated in this campus's strategic plan for us to become a top 10 university by all measures, and part of that concern, we're also we looked at some of the major elements that most institutions look at in assessing their quality as well as access. These key variables here, competitive salaries and benefits for the faculty and staff, are very important measures when looking at when external organizations look at ranking and they look at our faculty or when faculty consider whether to come to Cornell or not. And they look across their professions and their particular disciplines to see whether or not we offer competitive salaries and benefit packages are also important. We also are continuing to focus on providing changes in the curriculum and enriching our program so as to attract students. We need to be current and we have to invest in maintaining our currency as well as updating the kinds of material that we offer to classrooms as well as the type of instruction. We look at state support. State is an important part of our funding source and our advocacy. The state support over the last several years has been declining, and we have to make adjustments for that. I'm sure you are all aware that we have several tuition rates, but one of the most important ones when it comes to undergraduate students is the contract college rate and the endowed college rate, with the difference between those tuition rates being a very important part of our planning for the future and how we actually make sure that we have adequate resources or we receive adequate resources from the state to cover the cost of education for all of our students, whether contract college or endowed. Compliance is another major component in our concerns about the future. Regulations from the federal government, from state, with regard to research compliance and things that we have to do or mandates that come to the campus without additional funding is important and is a significant cost pressure, I believe, our vice president or vice provost for research services would say. We also have to continue with our facilities, the utility costs, they are market-based. But we also would like to keep our facilities up to date, the maintenance costs, depreciation, et cetera, required that we continue to invest in significantly in existing facilities. Supplies and materials, the cost of those change every time with the economy, with the market, so they are always changing. One of the major drivers for our outlook in the future, which has been an important part of my time here at Cornell, has been trying to get to a balanced budget, that structural budget as well as the operating budget that we have from year to year. So most of our policies and our outlook that we're setting forth now and the policies that we're putting in place are to help us maintain our efforts to get to a balanced budget and once we are there to maintain it and sustain it so that we don't fall back into some of the old habits that got us into some of the situation that we were in as an institution. We are also, like I said before, very cognizant of our market position, where we are in terms of major research institutions, where we are in terms of the Ivy, in terms of our ranking, our programs, as well as our cost, the cost of the sticker price, as well as the actual and real cost for students to attend the institution. It's an important part of our concerns for the future. So just to take a brief look, because there is a lot of conversation around undergraduate tuition and our increase of the undergraduate tuition by 4.5% for next academic year. The 4.5% increase, and this just shows you what we started with when we looked at what happened across our peers, the Ivy peers, and the Ivies are in the gray or in the band, and our other peers that we compete with, we believe, for academic quality as well. Cornell's policy has been to try to stay in the middle of that Ivy group so that we are not too pricey, but we are still not the lowest price. Part of the, if you look at the institutions that are here, they're the bottom in our peer set, Yale, Harvard, Princeton. Part of their ability to have such a lower tuition has to do with the size of endowment. So there are a lot of things that impact the operating budget, and the size of endowment is one of them. You'll see our other peers. So we're right where we want to be. We really want to be in the middle in terms of our actual sticker price and cost. And that's what I'll say about that. You can see the 4.7% increase from last year to this year was not the highest increase on that board, neither was it the lowest. You will notice, though, in terms of the tuition for the Ivy, if you look at the Ivy average, we were slightly below the Ivy average, so we were right at the Ivy average, even if when we increased our tuition at 4.7% and the average was 4%. So we believe that we are in the market, we're well placed and we're okay. Next slide. Also, just graduate students, professional students. Graduate students, there's no change in tuition. There hasn't been a change in tuition for graduate research degree in a number of years. That's part of an overall strategy that Cornell adopted several years ago to try to reduce, in fact, the graduate tuition to be more competitive. The graduate tuitions are more market-based and competing for major research institutions, so we're competing for students. And so because much of the tuition is waived, we're just setting the prices and competing with ourselves. We waive the tuition, we pay the tuition. So it's something that we'd like to, over the longer term, reduce even further. But at this time, it's we have to charge tuition because you have grants that pay tuition for students, and we have to remain competitive in that regard and also provide a price and cost as far as the value of the education is concerned. The professional degree tuition for professional schools, they're set by the individual colleges themselves, and theirs are very competitive, and they are market-based. On average, the professional programs are going up 4.5%, but some of them are not. Depending upon the school and the degree, the tuition will change. So these are professional degrees or degrees that are set by the graduate school. We also, at the last trustee meeting, approved a 3% graduate stipend increase. That 3% stipend increase next year was basically part of the salary improvement program that we have to make sure that we don't move around with regard to our competitive salaries for faculty and staff as well as the graduate students. Just to give you an idea, this is something that most of us don't talk about a lot. This is a slide of the graduate school tuition history, and these lines basically are just highlighting how the policy changed over the last several years. Starting in 2002, 2003 is where this began. The tuition for graduate students, so blue line here at the top is the professional degree tuition that's for the endowed. It's always been higher than the contract college tuition. The contract college professional degree tuition is the line at the bottom that's tracking that looks gold. What was happening then, early on, the contract college tuition, the research degrees, and the professional tuition, both were tracking together for a number of years. And then in 2008, 2007, there was a decision to make a change to try and lower the tuition for the endowed colleges, as well as lower the tuition, or keep at least steady the tuition for the contract college research degrees. The lowest line here is the research degree line, and the lowest line, the red line there, is the research degree line for the endowment. And basically, that was a campus decision to try to remain more competitive and deal with the internal market. Next slide. The other major important part of our budgeting, the endowment that's running close to $5 billion now, is a significant part of our operating budget. And the goal is for it to be steady and predictable. And so each year we run models to determine what, first of all, what the impact of the payout and the return on the endowment is going to be on our budget, and also to try to stay within the policy guidelines that the Board of Trustees developed. And so this year we are proposing that we're going to increase that by 4.5% in terms of the payout. For the last several years, however, the endowment wasn't changed. When it first dropped back in 2008-2009, it stayed the same, dropped it to $2.20 a share, and it stayed the same for a couple of years. The idea was to keep that endowment at that level and lower, depending upon how we responded to the market in terms of our investment returns. Our investment office had significant success, we believe, and they did in the last couple of years, and the returns were much higher than we thought they were going to be. So it allowed us the opportunity to recover some of that principal, the market value at any rate. And so we're moving this year to increase, like I said, by 4.5%, but basically that's 10 cents a share. We're moving from $2.20 a share to $2.30 a share. And that is significant for most of the colleges and schools, because a change in the endowment payout per share is an important part of their budget. And so when we don't make the returns, or if we adjust the payout downward, it's the same thing as the budget cut to them. One of the important parts of this particular policy that happened this year was that New York State passed a law that said you couldn't pay out on any endowment that was underwater. And as a result, we had a few endowments that were the newer ones that had been around a long time that were underwater, so we couldn't pay out on those endowments. It's not a very large part of the overall endowment portfolio, but it is significant for people that are relying on those payouts as part of their annual operating budget. So on to the budget model change. So with all this in the backdrop of what we're doing now and where we are trying to go and where we've come from, the university, as part of its Reimagining Cornell, had a task force focused on the budget model itself and how it should change and why it should change. The task force report gave us the note, I guess gave us notice that they wanted a model that was more transparent, that was simple, that was data-informed, and also they wanted to continue to be able to advance the academic excellence. They wanted the model to manage the cost pressures of the current environment. They wanted to improve service, quality, reduce costs, a host of other things to address and deal with the state cut. They were also cognizant of the fact that the president had a policy that stated that we wanted to decrease differential contributions and also deal with students' ability to pay their tuition bills as part of this new model. So what we did and what the campus did was appointed some committees to start beginning to talk about what a new model would look like. The task force framed for us the major concerns that the campus had. So some people thought that they gave us a model. What they gave us was a framework to begin to develop a model. And so what we've been doing for the last 2 years is going through the various components and elements of those recommendations, trying to find solutions for the Cornell community and involving as many people as we could in that process. The first committee that I had appointed last year to begin the process looked at each one of the major elements that they proposed, and they had conversations and made recommendations about the feasibility of the changes that had been recommended and what some of the alternatives were. We completed that work and presented to the provost a host of questions that remained to be answered, because this was part of the change that needs to take place on campus, is that we had to give and get a lot of feedback and buy-in because the committee report was made and recommended by a smaller group. And so we expanded that group to include about 65 more people to go through the different components. They came up with a list of questions, and the provost said, oh, my goodness, we've still got many more questions that we need to answer. So next slide. We formed another group we call the policy building kind of committee, which was a smaller group. We took the work, and we still are looking at the work of the larger groups and taking them into consideration. So on this group that we've been working with since the summer, every week, all summer long and all through the fall, back up until January, we had selected five deans to participate in the modeling and to think about what that process was going to be and what the policy should be. The deans included in that process were the deans of the College of Arts and Sciences, the deans of Cal, CIS, and engineering, and Vet Med. We meet with them, the provost and myself met with them, we talked about where we should go, and we started with looking at the campus as a whole. If we had to put everyone in the campus on the same budget model, what would it look like now in terms of just the revenues and the expenses? And we track those to see what it looked like in the current world in terms of the cost to each college and each school. After we did that, we went through basic components of the model. The budget model steering advisors, while we were developing the policy, we brought in the VC for, Vice Provost for Research, the Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education, the Vice Provost and Dean of the Graduate School, as well as the Vice Provost for the Land Grant Party Institution, Vice President for Facilities, and we also consulted with the University Faculty Senate Financial Planning Group as part of this process. And we went over a variety of recommendations. We modeled a lot of options to come to a document that was just presented to the deans in January around some of the policies that we were expected to try and move forward through the university community. So we're expecting that over the next several months, we will continue to talk with various groups, get feedback, and model the policies. Next slide. So these are basically the policies that we're looking to model. The undergraduate tuition and financial aid. So undergraduate tuition and financial aid, we spent a lot of time on that one because that's the largest part and one of the largest sources of our, single sources of our revenue. It's predictable and it's something that we control. We looked at pooling. The outcome of that group so far has been to say we should pool undergraduate tuition and we would pool the financial aid costs associated with that tuition. So this is how it would basically work. The undergraduate tuition for the endowed colleges already comes to the center, and we allocate budgets back out to the endowed colleges. Currently, the tuition for the contract colleges goes to those colleges, and they pay all their bills associated with it. Instead of going to those colleges, it would come through, all the tuition would go to a central pool, and it would be taxed at a rate that the campus agrees to go to fund central activity, and that's where the university support pool comes in. That was part of that recommendation. But once the tuition comes to that pool, it will be distributed back out to the colleges and schools that teach undergraduate students, or programs and activity that teach undergraduate students. What is different in this model that's very important is that the contract colleges would go through a process that we call truing up. So every student, every undergraduate student would have an equitable amount of tuition contributed to that pool. That means the state colleges would match tuition at a discount rate depending upon the institution's financial aid discount. They put an equitable amount of money in the pool from their state appropriation. So if the difference now is $16,000 in endowed tuition and contract college tuition, depending upon what the financial aid discount is of that tuition, they would put that much money in the pool to make it equitable. Now, how we distribute that, is, we're still in discussion around. We have several options out now that's being proposed, whether or not it's to a portion of it would go to the enrolling college, and a portion of it would go to the places where the students are actually taking courses, because the college is teaching the students. So right now, I guess it's not a dilemma, but what we're considering is what percentage should go to the home college of enrollment because they have additional costs associated with administering and managing the students, and what percentage should go to the out-of-college teaching. Many schools teach undergraduates, they teaches undergraduate students, but they're in a professional program, so they don't have undergraduate tuition, but they have costs associated with teaching undergraduate students. So whether or not it's based upon all teaching or out-of-college teaching is the conversation we're having now. After that's done, and we modeled four different scenarios, at 60, 40, and 70-30, in and out-of-college teaching or all teaching as part of those scenarios. Once the allocations of tuition is determined, then we look to see what the financial aid is cost for the campus are. Once we take off the institutional financial aid contributions from that total need pool, we then distribute the tuition across the colleges based upon their share of the tuition. We distribute the financial aid bill to each college based upon their share of the tuition resources and revenue that they receive. So no college is penalized because of the students that they have admitted because we have needs line admissions. So the institution takes responsibility to pay the financial aid from the resources that we receive, and that's distributed across the college. The thing that's important in this particular scenario is that because colleges raise funding for financial aid for their particular college, they are not penalized in any way for having raised the resources for financial aid, because once they get their bill, they can use their endowed funds, their fundraising money, to pay their part of or any portion of their financial aid bill. So they're actually paying the balance. So their incentive, basically, to raise money for financial aid. And they would pay the balance from other sources that they have, whether it be tuition or other gifts that they do have. So that's kind of how the undergraduate tuition is being discussed. It took us a long time to get to, probably at least a year, to get to this particular point where we believe that it's an equitable situation for the students as well as for the colleges and schools. For the students, because now they're able to take a course, they should be able to take a course anywhere without being concerned that they're paying less tuition than another student in another area. The Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education is working on policies to try and inform the behavior associated with student movement across campus so that with anything, people begin to try and figure out how they're going to gain the model to get more tuition in one place or another. And they're working on that, and we've had feedback from the Faculty Senate Financial Planning Committee about some strategies to make sure that we're able to sustain and maintain this type of a model going forward. Space use and charging for space was a significant new idea that was introduced by the Budget Model Task Force. So what we have done in that regard is we launched a space study using some consultants to work with the campus to identify the different types of space that we have so that when we do charge for space, if we charge for space,
it's 6:05.
Okay, yep.
We've got time on our agenda, but I know you have to go.
Okay, I'm going to rush things. The space use committee is going to look at the space, they're going to identify it, they're going to type it, and then we'll have basically three models of space or ways that we can charge for space. We've developed some space use guidelines also so that people that have differing budgets and control space, once we can establish ownership, don't charge people to use their space at rates that are not being, that have no control. So basically the space use guidelines are set forth to say, and an interdepartmental fee to say that if you want to charge for space in your facility, you need to go through a committee of your peers so they can determine whether or not you're charging fair market rates and you're increasing your rates at a fair way. So that's kind of what the space use policy change is going to be about. The cost allocation methodology, CAM, which you may hear something about is how we distribute administrative costs across the campus. The metric for that is going to change. It used to be revenue. Now it's going to be based upon the number of students, faculty, staff that you have, and basically the people that actually use your services rather than just the how much revenue or income you bring in. Facilities and administrative costs are still being talked about. Basically, what we're going to do is do away with two different ways of distributing FNA for research grants. The goal right now is to distribute it out to all of the colleges and the faculty that actually bring in the FNA rather than half of it in one model going to the center and in the other model it's going to the colleges. State appropriations, nothing much has changed with that. Graduate tuition, no changes recommended with that. We have done two things in this model that have changed already. And that is the Cornell Abroad has moved to GP funding and the fee for studying abroad has been dropped. And that's to give all students a better chance of being able to study abroad without exorbitant fees and other students having to pay those fees to balance out the cost by subsidize other students. So we're going to pay it from the GP budget and we put it in the GP budget this year. And the fees are being lowered every year for Cornell Abroad activities. Endowed professorships that used to be held at the center have just been pushed out to the colleges to manage. And that's where we are. I'll take one or two questions and then I'm
sure. Are there any questions? Thanks for a wonderful presentation. Rebecca? I think you're talking about this one?
Yeah. Right. This particular chart does not compare the contract college tuition. It's just comparing the contract college non-resident tuition with our peers because they're private. And to compare the contract college in-state student cycle, we compare the state tuition. Yeah.
Can I jump in? Briefly, I'm curious to see that the corporation brought in about 2.5% of our revenue and then expenses were 4.2%. And I was just curious about that shortfall.
4.2%, go back to the number one, and then revenue
2.6.
That's a percentage of our overall budget. And why are you saying why are they their revenues short?
I'm curious. I'm sorry. I have a look actually. That's why I'm interested in this. But the Carter Foundation brought in 2.6%, and then their expenses were what?
So here's the difference. One is the percentage of our overall expenditure budget, and one is the percentage of our revenue.
Oh, okay.
Right, our expenditures are much.
Chris? So really quickly, a couple slides before this, you mentioned that graduate student stipends, I'm guessing just the minimum graduate student stipend over a 12-month period is raising by 3%. How often is that increased?
Well, it was increased last year, and I think a couple of years ago, there was no increase.
Okay.
So we've been trying to, as a result of that, keep pace when we increase the stipends for the campus increases to the stipends as well.
Who decides on the increase? What the increase?
The trustees are the final deciders on that, but the recommendations are from the vice provost for graduate school and the human resources vice president, as well as the vice president, provost and vice president of research.
Okay, thank you.
I had a very quick question as well. I recall that a couple of years ago there was discussion about equalizing graduate tuition at the contract and the endowed colleges, and that was going to be done by lowering the endowed research degree tuition, which of course you can see there, but then of course the financial crisis hit to put a stop to that. My question is basically, do you know if there's a plan going forward as the budget outlook improves to continue that trend?
I think that's the idea. The question will be when, but
what the idea, we talk about it every year, and we believe that we do want to do that.
Okay. Thank you very much. If there are other questions, you can certainly send them to me, and I'll pass them along.
Okay,
thank you. With that, we move to the remainder of our agenda. First on the agenda is the approval of the minutes, which were circulated by email. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Any corrections? Seeing none, is there any objection to the approval of the minutes? Seeing none, the minutes are approved. Thank you, thank you. We move now to reports of officers and committee updates. First is the Executive Committee. On behalf of Nicole, who's at the panel that you may have heard about on graduate student advisor relationships, she wanted me to mention that the Resolution 7 ad hoc, am I getting that number right? I hope so. Anyway, the ad hoc on teaching, advising, and mentoring of graduate and professional students will meet for the first time on Wednesday. That's this Wednesday, February 22nd, 11 a.m. In Mandeville or the Mann Lobby Library or wherever a table can be found. That's the right time, isn't it? 11? Yes. Excellent. Another thing for me, of course, is to say again, I know we mentioned this at our last meeting, if the GPSA is something you want to be involved with, or if you just like free food. We're certainly interested in thinking about transition to next year, and the sooner we can start thinking about that, the better. So if you're a field rep or just a general graduate student of any kind, graduate or professional student, and you want to serve as a voting rep, committee chair, an officer, participate in committees next year, now's the time, now's a great time to start thinking about that. So if that's something you're interested in, certainly a great way to get more information is to talk to the person whose position you might like to pursue the following year, or of course talk to me and I'll put you in touch with wherever you might want to go. So there's that. Marquise, anything? All right. Appropriations, Chris.
Nothing besides the fact that in 2 weeks we're going to be presenting some changes to the byline criteria, procedures, document. It's going to involve also sort of agreement that we're going to be entering into as a result of giving money to the groups that we voted on at the end of last semester. In that, there will be discussions about, you know, we need to get the big red sports pass in order to keep on paying athletics and amount of money that we're paying them, and also discussions about closed days. So,
Communications, Steve?
Yeah, thanks. So hopefully you all noticed over the weekend that the train popped up in your inbox. So this is pretty exciting. It's the first time we actually got to spam all graduate, email.
Inform.
Come up with. That's all. And of course, if you want to get your picture next year,
It's interesting to note, so the list started out with, I believe, 6,013 subscribers this went to. We've seen very few unsubscribe requests, under 10 the last time I checked, which either it's getting caught in everybody's spam filters, or people like what they see. I believe it's the latter, but Steve may believe it's the former. Finance Commission, Mia.
Hi. So we had a meeting last week, and we looked at just over $16,000 of requests on your budget for FTR, and we allocated $8,441.18. So we have just under $16,000 left in the pot. So I feel like I keep saying to everybody, oh, this is going to be our last funding cycle. You have to get your applications in, and I'm thinking about those words again. And saying we're having another meeting in a couple of weeks. But this really is going to be the last one.
Anything that's left after that just goes to the president.
And the salary. So please get an application by next week. That's March, Friday, March.
The third?
Second. Yeah. For FCL's and annual budget for anything that's going on the rest of this semester. Because it's the last one, please make sure they're as detailed as possible, because we had turned down quite a few people last week because we had to carry the application. A couple of tentative dates, so these aren't set in stone yet, but tentatively April the 7th, which is a Saturday, I'm going to be running a brief annual budget seminar. So it'll be about an hour and a half, and I'll go through the annual budget process for everybody. Obviously, we haven't gone through it before. So if anybody has any questions before looking in their annual budget, so make sure to bring them to that. So tentatively April 7th, but you'll get a confirmation about that coming soon. And tentatively April 27th, that's a Friday, will be the deadline for the annual budget application. And that'll be reviewed shortly afterwards.
Have you started thinking about the big review date?
Yes. That is tentatively May the 5th.
May the 5th. And I imagine you might be interested.
Yeah, a mass reviewing session where food will be provided, and we will be very, very, very grateful to anybody who can come and lend a hand. But tentatively May 5th, but again,
it's a wonderful opportunity if you're interested in maybe being on the FC next year to,
yes,
to get your feet wet, as it were. Steve, question?
Can you just repeat the deadline for
Oh, for our next...
for this semester.
Oh, for this semester, the SDRs, it will be Friday, March 2nd, end of next week.
Any other questions? Seeing none, student advocacy, Rebecca.
All right, so we're in the final stages of analyzing the transcripts from the event we held last December. And we're realizing the quality of nature of the data is wonderful and generating a lot of direction for the future work. So two new things to report. We're moving the data to the Wealth, the University Council on Wealth, Student Wellness, Welfare and Mental Health. So that's what every book means and movers and shapers. So hopefully I'll be effective and generate the discussion. And we're also thinking about maybe doing another survey, quality of life related, or proposing doing that. So those are two main streams of work. And then I'll be looking out for anybody or hearing any issues.
Thanks. Programming board, Wajah.
Upcoming event announcement. We're piloting a new event called Speed Friending at the Big Good Bar in 2 weeks. Although our interschool mixers have been very successful, very well attended, great ambience, this might be for some people who need more structure in how to make friends. So come on and try it out. Make friends either platonic or not.
It's the opposite of Socratic.
So less pressure. to bar with your friends. And 2 days after that, our wonderful Michelle and Carl will be hosting the second third night of Ithaca ever. We'll also come out to that after TJ.
We just figured out what the talks are going to be on.
What now?
Talk one is on surf guitar, your favorite musical genre, you don't know, you know. Second talk is Satan from Nameless Angel, which is fine for us. And then the third talk is Rolf Kopter, totally a word you ever change in record.
Isn't that Raffle Kopter? let the record show, Chris Heckman, Raffle Kopter. YJ.
So event announcement for real estate association, associate real estate council. So they're the association for real estate students, where they would like to increase their membership base because they feel like many students across disciplines would be interested in things having to do with real estate, engineering, law. Everybody might have great. And so they're starting a mixer next Wednesday at the barn. They'll have a band, they'll have free beer and pizza, they'll have a DJ. And they told me that this is also, the reason I agreed to advertise, is this is also, they're not going to plug too much real estate in the evening. This is also a place for everybody to go make friends. So,
not to meet Donald Trump.
Drop by if you have friends. Another announcement is our meetings are set every other Monday at 7 when GPSA is not meeting until spring break. And so if you would like to, you know, see what we're doing or have other programs you would like to pilot, then come by. We meet in the Physical Sciences Building 403 or send me an email back.
Great. So we move now, unless there are questions for YJ. Further etymological musings or entomological musings. Okay, stop with the puns. We move now to our first item of new business, and that's the approval of the president, that's me, and my report to the Board of Trustees. So this was sent out again via email on Friday, helpfully with numbered lines for you to read over. So much like any other resolution, I'm happy to, not happy to attain, you know, the property of the assembly if there are any amendments, corrections, so on and so forth. And if not, I would certainly entertain a motion to approve, the report. Did everybody read the report? I'm seeing some nodding. That's good. That's good. I have an issue with line number one. No. No thoughts, suggestions, changes, so on and so forth? Seeing none, does someone wish to move the approval of the report?
Well, I can just make a comment about it.
Certainly.
Okay.
So we've got 10 minutes on the agenda for this. I'm just going to sit here until we...
So, the idea of this report is that at the March meeting of the Board of Trustees, each year, Evan and his counterpart on the FSA president will come and give a 5-minute talk to the board trustees. So this is sort of in advance of that talk, a little bit about what happened on the assembly this year. And I think, it could be easy to say that, they receive a lot of material. But from what I've heard from them, that this is something that they do appreciate and that they do look over. And I think, particularly with how it's structured this year, it touches on a lot of issues that the board has discussed, and so I think it's a good person to that. It's really the main opportunity in the year for the trustees to hear about what's going on in this assembly. Instead of taking time out of the meeting, it's really an important opportunity. So I think it is just to emphasize the importance of this report.
This is a meeting, as you know, that for the first time the board has invited Natalie and me to sit in as part of the whole board meeting, as well as to attend the Student Life Committee and the Academic Affairs Committee. So I think the board is making great strides in terms of outreach on campus and so on and so forth. So as Derek said, in addition to the written report, I'll be speaking. Of course, a lot of that is going to be highlights of this report, but if there are, you know, particular issues, concerns, so on and so forth, I'm always, my door is usually closed, but my email box is often open, so feel free to reach out, as always. Any other thoughts about the report? Comments, questions, queries, conundrums? Other alliterative things? Chair would entertain a motion to approve the report.
So moved.
Moved by Marquise. Is there a second? Seconded by Allison. Those in favor, please raise your green placard. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Those opposed? 0. With a vote of 17 to 0, the report is approved, and I will send it tonight. Thank you. We move now to Resolution 10, a resolution altering the GPSA committee staffing process. Marquise Hawkins. I'll put it up for you.
Okay, cool. So over the last several
years, might take a second.
We've been...
It's tough, I know.
Over the last several years, we've been trying to encourage more involvement and more incorporation in the body with the field reps. And, I speak sort of from experience. I was elected from SEPA thinking that I was going to come and do some broad sweeping changes and all kinds of things. And I got here and just couldn't find my way. I had to really talk to people and understand how the body worked at first, and then after that, the semester's over, and then elections happen and all these kinds of things. And you sort of get wrapped up with not being able to have the impact that you think that you will initially. And so I am being the chair of the Operations Staffing Committee this year has also allowed me to reflect on things that we could do better going forward. And I definitely think that making it mandatory for all members of the GPSA to serve on a committee would be one of those steps that we need to make to get everybody more engaged, to get people more involved in how this body is working. So, as you all can read in the resolution, it's going to be a charter change as well as a bylaw change. And it would require everyone to serve on, at minimum, one internal or university-wide committee. So, at last count, I think today, we are at 80% filled with the committees for the GPSA staff, and 60% of the external committees are staffed. So, I mean, we're not necessarily, in my opinion, using our full power here. We're not being represented on, the Graduate Voices just not being represented on some of the university's boards, and I for one think that they should be. And by having this particular change, this first gives the Operations Staffing Committee a pool of in excess of 100 people to choose from to staff those committees initially, and then reach out to the graduate student community at large next. And so I think that this is a fantastic way to get people involved. That this is something, again, I have to reiterate, that this is something that we've been trying to do over the last several years, and I think that this is a great way forward. So I'll take questions, and we're not going to be able to vote on this today. Procedurally, it's required that it come up meeting before.
I can outline.
Oh yeah,
So this is an amendment to the charter and the bylaws, because they're presented jointly. The higher standard takes the precedence. That means that it requires 2/3 of voting members to vote in the affirmative in order to pass it. It requires what Robert's Rules lovingly calls prior notice, which means that it's presented today, can be discussed, can be amended today, but there will not be a vote on passage today. That will come in 2 weeks. And ultimately, changes to our charter require presidential approval. Not me, but it's a big man, David Scorton. In the case of something like this, it's a fairly small adjustment. I don't anticipate objections, but that's part of the process. Could I ask a question, Marquis?
Yes, absolutely.
So you said in your presentation, you said all members.
Yeah.
The resolution as written only requires field representatives to serve on committees. Is it your intention that voting members also be required to serve on committees?
That is the intention, and I guess I'll accept an amendment to say that. But in that particular section of the bylaws that is germane to field representative responsibilities, there I'll entertain a guess.
So the amendment would be something like the first language, the bit in the first resolve clause, would have to be inserted as well into 404A after 3. So that would give voting members 4 responsibilities: remain informed, elect officers. So that would adjust line 10. Would say something like that the following language be inserted before section 403A2
and
after 404A3.
Right.
And the other amendment would modify the second resolve clause to change the language to the placement of all GPSA members on at minimum.
Right.
That's the amendment.
I'm fine with that language, but in the bylaws, I think that specific section is germane to only the field representative responsibility.
I think that section of the bylaws applies to the responsibilities of the operations and staffing committee.
Really? Okay. Then that's fine. Absolutely.
Is there a second to the amendment?
I can second
it. Yes, you can exactly. Second it. The amendment is seconded. Yeah. Is there discussion on the amendment? John?
Yes, I think both of the field reps' willingness to accept this. So a survey of field reps as to how they feel about this, because some voting members, I mean, we're actively, we chose to take on this position to be active in the GPSA on and all the committees. You know, if someone can't dedicate that time, you know, maybe they're like, I'd rather be a field rep. I want to be involved, but, you know, I can't commit to actively being on a committee. Additionally, I think, in addition to asking them their opinion, so like a survey, but to also introduce some kind of new communication into those vacancies. I mean, I don't know how many people were aware of that, but, you know, there's a 60% fill rate. I know I wasn't. So I guess some kind of communications, a portion of this, as to, you know, which positions are vacant and which ones do certain people fit well with. And so I think this problem needs some more investigation before it passes. But the solution, I mean, it seems like a very reasonable solution, and I would have no issues voting for it. I just think it needs a little more vetting to get more opinions.
Just out of curiosity, were people aware that there were committee vacancies, or were people generally, hand up if you were aware that there were vacancies? Okay, thank you. Marquis, you had a comment?
Yeah, I would submit that with the responsibility piece, their committee's responsibilities are really wide-ranging. Some only once a year, all the way up to once a week. So, I mean, we could find places to put people who have an issue with the time management issue there. But I definitely do think that we should get the opinions on field representatives on this. I think buy-in is extremely crucial.
Randa, I saw first.
Yeah, I'm concerned that there might be a deterrent effect in people's involvement in GPSA, because I know personally that we already have trouble finding people that want to get involved, and this is a lot of extra work for us. We also have to serve on our own committees at the law school, and adding another requirement would make it almost impossible to find someone who would be willing to take on that much more, and I don't think that the law school would be the only place where that's an issue. And I think, honestly, people are devoted to committees because they choose to be there. If you require it, you're probably going to get a lot of people that are forced to go to meetings even once a year, but not really care and not really put the effort that's required to make it functional at all. So I think making it a requirement is too staunch of a standard, in my opinion.
Madeline?
Yeah, so I agree with that. I'm in information science, which is a really small field, and I'm the first rep we've ever had to use this before. I mean, with a small field, it's hard to get people to volunteer for something. And we've already essentially doubled the requirements of a field rep by increasing the number of meetings that field reps attend. So I think adding on extra commitments would really deter a lot of people. Also, I'm wondering how much would be enforced. I think we're going to end up with people who aren't at the committee and then never kind of work.
I'm sort of writing down people as they put their hands up. The next person I have on my list is Alex from English.
Yes, thank you. I was just going to comment. I have some similar issues. So I don't want to get into the work, but I think it's is just the lack of participation from field representatives in general. You know, I know that there are a number of fields that are not the members here, so.
About 60% of positions are filled.
So, you know,
it's similar to the committee.
More people you have on that end, you would think it would triple the size of that.
Next on my list is, Creston.
My question is more from the organizational structure of the CCSA, sort of approaching this problem in a on-the-ball fashion rather than talent. From a structural problem that we've had consistently is that we staff in the community here, but the field representatives are elected at on a rolling basis at each department that you sit. And so how would you envision the GDSA increasing the stringency on something that we have to go and go over?
Well, I guess great. Those are the minority of the cases, really. Is that not correct? That most people, most of the field reps are seated prior to that first meeting.
Actually, the majority of departments elect their field reps to the civil engineering elected in February. And so then you even have turnovers.
Wouldn't there be someone serving in that capacity still though? Until that vacancy.
Yes, but then when they inherit the seat on a committee that's previously held by a person that was
So I think that that's something that the office staff, I think, in the bylaw provision, I think that they should come up with the procedures. That's something that could be variable from year to year, but my position is that they should be on a committee of their choosing.
Correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going to try and frame this into information. Is it not correct that committee staffings are for the academic year in general? So would it not be correct that even if there were turnover in field representatives midterm, the prior field representative would still be held to the standard of being on that committee unless they were to resign from the seat?
Yeah, it's the individual. The chair can answer the point of information if that's all right. It's the individual who's staffed to a particular committee. Of course, even if, I should say, the chair is entirely neutral on this resolution, I think it's important that we have this discussion regardless of what the outcome is. The individual is staffed to the position, not the field. And there would still be, even if every field rep were required to serve on a committee, there would still be additional vacancies beyond that, so non-field representatives would also be on committees too. The appointment terms tend to be the same as the GPSA terms, so that's June 1st to May 31st. So yeah, the short answer is, if you're appointed to be on the SA's Committee on Women's Issues in September, you serve on that committee until the end of May, even if you're no longer the field rep for civil engineering come February.
So to the earlier point, I think that the allowing the field reps to really have wide-ranging choice between which committees they want to serve on will allow for that issue of people being disengaged. I mean, I'm going to say this, and it's not going to be PC, but to say that people in this room don't have perhaps one day to serve throughout the academic year because they're so busy, I just don't buy that. I mean, it just seems far-fetched. I mean, all of us here on this board and on the e-board are extremely involved. Evan is not only president, he sits on three other committees, and he's a teaching assistant,
and he teaches two classes.
Oh, goodness knows.
So certainly everybody has responsibilities, but I mean, to be able to sit on at least one committee that meets once a year or twice a year, I think that's certainly, and it's not something that, when we say it's going to be a requirement, it doesn't say that you have to serve on a committee that meets once a week. You're going to be required to sit on a committee that that fits in your schedule, as it were. So it's up to, certainly it would be up to the option staff to create the procedures, but I think that if option staff sees that a person can't commit to that much, then I'm going to assign them more than they're willing to do so.
I think the most frequent committees meet probably every other week.
Yes.
Yevgeny?
So I just want to say that certainly great resolution and you can see how many comments you have and what you do the things you think about here. And I'm not sure if this is the best way to go about it, but I actually had a conversation with a few of our farming chemistry and biology, and I've gotten some voting members and a few members to join, but I think it doesn't come. And if I'm not going to vote, it's not as my job. I think if one of them, those things come up. And I think this is definitely something that you probably all think, but we all want to be involved. So we're here, so we want to be support. And maybe that emphasis can be on communication, is that right now the way it's working for me, at least, that I email them and say, you know, come by, so it's going to be talking about, but maybe it can come even more directly to the GSA, if someone was engaging the skills out there that are there. And so I think maybe that could be an answer, because right now, we definitely don't have a requirement to field reps to attend all the meetings, right? I understand. So you need to help do it.
The language says something like, the executive vice president shall notify the chair of the finance commission of a sustained vacancy in a position. This has been a provision that we, at least in my time here, have not enforced. I don't know of a single field rep who's been ejected for lack of attendance.
But I would be really in support of something that is both communicating and engaging field reps, because in the end, I think people want to know, like what you mentioned, want to know about opportunities and how they can.
Next, I saw YJ.
I'd like to
and then Rebecca.
Along another vein, not focusing on theater, but focusing on people outside of GPSA. So prior to being involved in the GPSA, I didn't even know these university committees existed, much less that I could serve on them as a graduate student. So I'd like to echo what Yevgeny was saying in terms of we have a marketing problem and a communications problem. I feel that rather, in my opinion, rather than saddle all field reps with the responsibility of attending and serving on another committee to broaden the base, to reach more people. And I think in a graduate community of 8,000 people, there's bound to be somebody who's interested in something that you're looking for. And so I would say we as a body also need to get out there and tell people and communicate how fun it is and how rewarding it is being involved and everything like that. So I mean, yeah, so that's what I mean.
I'll add you to my list. We'll spend about 10 more minutes on this, not more. The number of people I have on my list is about 10-ish, so I'll limit people to 60 seconds or so. Next on my list is Rebecca.
About
dropped out, so there could be a parent that it was filled, but then someone did, it wasn't unable to fulfill the requirement, so now they're going back out. So some sort of iteration system might be a good way, so people just could go to. You don't have to be there.
Chris?
So I think that it's a problem maybe of how we're getting out to people and not telling enough people about the opportunities, but I think there's also an issue about inertia. You have a group in this room that is coming to a bunch of meetings with the GPSA with a seven doctor involved in the committee. It's probably because, it might be because we're not communicating how much fun it is, but it could also be because we don't have enough of a system of rewards or really suggesting that they should do this. This is one way of doing it. It's perhaps not the way that I would have thought of, but it is certainly one way. Another way, just thinking off the top of my head, is saying, well, everyone here is a member of a field, and if you want to join a committee, then your field gets an extra $100 or something, Then I will launch. My field can actually benefit from me doing this, and I'm going to join something that I want to do. If I really am not interested in it, then I'm not interested. That's just one option. But I think there are probably others.
Mia?
Okay, to be quick, I completely agree with YJ. I was going to say basically that. Two issues. A, there's only so many committees that only require sort of a one-day commitment per year.
Right.
So I think still there might be an issue of everybody fighting over those committees and not wanting to serve on the others if it's mandatory. An issue of people who are already, say, heavily involved in their own departments, who are serving as a sales rep for their department because they're the most involved person, so they're a good representative to come here, but they already have a lot of commitment into their own student organisation. Just one option to look into, I think you could perhaps be clear about time commitment to the thing, which really, really spell it out as we're doing it to advertising.
Eric?
With or without the extra $100 would get for joining the committee, would it make sense at all to maybe add some language to say not specifically the GPSA member, but someone from their field? If not the member, someone from the field could go in their stead, or scrap the GPSA member language altogether and just say someone from that field. If you have a representation in the GPSA, someone should. So that might be a way of including people and not piling too much on any one person.
Nighthawk, then Carl.
Regardless of the constraints that this puts on people, I think it's important to gather information on the constraints that people are feeling with this. I wouldn't call it an extra burden, I call it an extra opportunity. But I think Marquis started off by saying that maybe the reason he was thinking about this resolution was the idea that in the past year we've expanded the involvement of members in the GPSA because we want them to see more fully what campus governance is about, making sure that all GPSA members were involved in all the meetings so they could see what campus governance is about. And so, from the point of view, and again, removing this from the added work component, thinking about what the GPSA is about, what campus governance is about, a lot of what campus governance is about the committees. And even if it can only be on one committee, I think it helps you understand the committee structure a lot more and the role of that campus governance. The last thing I'd say, I encourage you to go to the minutes from either September of 1998 or September of 1996, when the exact same resolution basically was on the docket. And check out what was said then.
I believe it's described as a perennial problem. Am I? Two guys who've read the minutes from the 90s. That says something, and I'm not sure it's good. Carl?
So I agree with a lot of what the person was saying. Still some of the comments, so I think moving forward, this is really the final one. What field reps would want, what sort of things would motivate them to be involved, and things like that. But I also wonder how much, if Yeah, so I think somebody said there are 50% of fields have a field representative.
About that. I can't pull up this spreadsheet now. So, go on.
60% here. So I wonder if it may be more effective to try and actually institute ways to ensure the field representatives actually come to GPS interview, which then I would assume would have some trickle down effect in the higher staff.
$10.
Thanks. Elizabeth, and then in the back.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to point out that I think that's something that we've been hearing throughout the room is the community has sort of been a black box if you're new to the GPSA. And I had help at Rebecca's in my department, and Chris Clark, you know, there to help me out. And I know that I had a lot of trouble navigating and figuring out where I can be most helpful. So I think maybe what we should think about for the fall, when we have an influx of new field reps, is sort of like an educational component or a communication component. So what committees do, where can you best be helpful, and just in general, helping people try to orient themselves when they come here, which I don't think necessarily assigns them to a committee would fill that gap.
So an idea that we were sort of kicking around was instead of this rather complicated procedure that is required for applying for a committee right now, was maybe a sort of interest-based matching system of some kind, where you would put yourself in, you would say, these are the kinds of things I'm interested in, and then ops and staffing, who knows the committees, might try and match people who voluntarily have put their name in the hat, rather than something. Is that...
Or even like a speed dating, speed friending night with the committees.
Yeah.
I was going to say
speed friending for committees. Write it down. In the back, and then John. John, and that'll be our final comment.
I really like what you brought up with letting people know what the committees do. We had an ad hoc committee that's supposed to work on the new grad student orientation or something. You know, that could be, you could throw this in there with, how do you talk about the different committees at that orientation.
Yeah.
You can also do a, I love the brainstorming stuff. So we could do a committee day, people stand up to talk about the committees and what to do, or speed dating, speed friending, speed committee friending.
Right.
Anyway, so.
So I think this discussion has been fascinating and helpful. Pardon?
Your amendment has to be.
Yeah, technically we should have been debating the merits of my amendment, and we should have been voting on that, and so on and so forth. I think what we actually discussed was especially helpful, and of course gets at the merits of the resolution. I want to say personally, it's incredibly interesting. I got involved with the GPSA 3 years ago as a field rep who felt that committees were a black box and didn't know what was going on, and it's all a communication issue, and so it's fascinating to sort of sit on the other side of it and realize that nothing's changed. So I think what the real problem here is, we need new leadership. I think that whoever is running the GPSA, but seriously, moving forward, I think that the idea of a survey or something like that is a wonderful idea. I think that we can also do more to get out the word. I know Steve and I have already been in correspondence about the next issue of the big buzz going out to everybody. As we start to think about staffing for next year, get involved with the GPSA committees, voting membership, so on and so forth, to make sure that really people across the campus are aware of the opportunities that the GPSA presents for you to get involved and to make a difference. Certainly there's more to be done. I think we can streamline our process. I think there's more to be done there too. I think that we've had 2-3 years of a real attempt to shift the culture. I think we've made progress. I think there's more work to do. We have a couple of options. We can just put this resolution back on the docket next week. We take it off the table, or maybe you want to do some more.
Yeah, I definitely want to do some more fact finding and welcome anybody here who has any ideas. I think that especially Chris' idea was one that could be incorporated. But yeah, I definitely want to hear more about what people have to say about this. So yeah, we could go ahead and not put it on 2 weeks' docket.
Not do it?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. So you withdraw your resolution?
Yes.
Okay. Is there any objection? Is there any objection to the withdrawal of the resolution? I want to make sure I dot my parliamentary I's and cross my parliamentary T's. Seeing no objection, the resolution is withdrawn. We'll move now into open forum for our remaining 3 minutes. Amy has passed me a note indicating that there are two GPSA T-shirts for free. Now don't all run up to Amy at once at the end of the meeting. I've got one of these T-shirts. It's gray. It says GPSA on the front. All of my friends think I'm really cool. So don't all come to Amy at once. If you don't take them, she's going to throw them out. They've been sitting in her office for a year.
2 years.
Further comments in open forum? Elizabeth?
Recently I had an attempt to lure my cohort and other graduate students out. I had a coffee hour. Because I figured if you have coffee, then people are going to shut up the love. In any case, a couple of the things that we discussed was transportation issues. People were having difficulty with the keypad, having difficulty with parking, that sort of thing. And also, issues with caretakers for basically opportunities for parents, for grad students to have their children over, taken care of and daycare. I know that we have a more free agenda this semester.
The GPSA would certainly, the chair would certainly love for you to get involved on those issues in any way that you want. Thanks for the pitch. There are committees you might be interested to know that deal with these issues. The Campus Infrastructure Committee has been talking about parking. Maybe Eric would happily talk to you about that. The Campus Welfare Committee has also been talking about children and the graduate student children care options. You'd be interested to know that there's a vacancy on that committee. Christine?
We do have a couple of grad students who are members of the CCAT Advisory Committee, which is more for these kind of issues than the board of CCAT, and I'm one of them. I know we talked about transportation issues last time, so I wonder if it warrants a broader discussion about transportation issues. The CCAT staff is very interested to hear what we think of grad students especially, so maybe that's
if you'd like to come talk to the executive, we can figure out something on the agenda. Christine.
I just want to say that there are people in my field as well who are concerned about children and about the state of graduate students.
About 10%, by the way, of graduate students have children. A lot of people don't know that. Further comments in open forum? Otherwise, the chair would entertain a motion to adjourn. Moved by Chris, seconded by Marquise. Is there any objection? Seeing none. We continue next week, 2 weeks, March 5th. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.